Mikhail Khodorkovsky is getting more time behind bars. The man, widely considered Prime Minister Vladimir Putin's political rival, was found guilty at a second trial today of stealing billions of dollars from his own company. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the ex-tycoon's conviction raises questions about the rule of law being overshadowed by political considerations. Khodorkovsky was once Russia's wealthiest man. He was in his final year of an 8-year sentence from a previous conviction when today's verdict was announced. Italian police have defused a parcel bomb found at the Greek embassy in Rome today. It was similar to two others that exploded last Thursday at two other embassies. No injuries reported in the latest incident. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Well, when you think about the state of Illinois, think about the images that really represent the state. I don't know what you think about, but I think it probably has a lot to do with where it is you live. I expect people in Chicago, they think about skyscrapers and the lake. And if you live in the central part of the state, maybe you think about corn and soybeans. But the fact is that Illinois, a lot of Illinois, is coal country. And that is something that I think a lot of people don't realize. In fact, a lot of Illinoisans probably don't realize that. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about coal and how it helped to shape the land and the people of the southern part of the state, coal mining particularly, how that had an effect on both the environment and people. And our guest for the show is Jeff Biggers, and we'll be talking about some of what you will find in his book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. It is published by Nation Books. He's an American Book Award-winning writer. His books include The United States of Appalachia and In the Sierra Madre. He's worked as a writer and radio correspondent across the U.S., also Europe, India, Mexico. He regularly blogs for The Huffington Post and for Grist, and his stories have been heard on National Public Radio and Public Radio International, and he's written for a number of other publications. He will be visiting in our area next week, as a matter of fact. The folks at the Prairie Rivers Network are sponsoring a book signing and a talk by Jeff, and he will be talking on the U of I campus on Monday, next Monday, that's the 25th, and he will be giving his talk in Gregory Hall. That's room 100, Gregory Hall, on the U of I campus at 6:30 on Monday. So if you're interested, you can certainly stop by. And if you would like to take a look at the book, well, of course, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Well, Jeff Biggers, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I kind of think the place to begin is kind of as I did begin, because I really think, you know, the images that people have of Illinois, probably most people don't. They're not thinking about the fact that Illinois is a coal-producing state or has an important history of coal. And as I said, I'm sure there are probably a lot of Illinoisans who really don't know that.
Right, especially even in your area. And I think very few people realize that the birth of strip mining, for example, where we get most of our coal today in America, took place, you know, right within your listenership, right outside of Danville, Illinois, that some of our oldest mines in America actually are right there in the Champaign-Urbana and Danville area. So coal really goes all the way back. In fact, the first discovery of coal in North America by the Europeans was actually in Illinois, along the Illinois River outside of Peoria by the French, and that goes all the way back to the 1600s. So it's really one of our oldest industries, if not one of our oldest cultural heritage and histories we have in the state.
Yeah, and I guess the reason, and also I suppose would explain the reason for strip mining, is that there are a lot of places where the coal was visible. You could see it. You didn't have to dig hundreds of feet down into the ground. It was just right there.
Yeah, you know, the outcroppings in the early days especially were very rich, and so they just take a horse and a plow and start scraping away at the coal they saw. And typically it was related to a lot of the salt reserves. Likewise, for example, around Danville, there were some very rich salt reserves, of course, that the pioneers needed to function in their communities. In order to get the salt, you have to boil the salt. And so you would use wood, but that wood essentially was chopped down quite quickly. And so they turned to things like coal, which was really all around them, to start their salt industry.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I guess that there are, geologically, there are reasons why those two things can tend to be associated, coal and salt. But then there's also this practical thing that in the manufacture of salt, you've got to have an energy source. And so that also was a way that facilitated, energized, you know, it was a reason to dig up the coal so you could have something to burn so that you could generate the energy so that you can also then produce the salt.
Mm-hmm. And that's the same story we're dealing with today. You know, think about it. Your listeners flicked on their radio, flicked on their computers, flicked on their electricity today. And somebody has to create that energy, and there's no electricity fairy who magically is bringing electricity to our homes. It's mostly coming from coal-fired plants for many of us in the Midwest.
Yeah, and I think that's probably an important point to emphasize. We talk a lot about the energy that we use in this country, and we certainly have a big need for liquid transportation fuels, so there's a whole set of issues that have to do with that. But also we have a huge demand and an ever-growing demand for electricity, and there are only so many ways that you can produce that, and a lot of the electricity in this country, as you say, is produced by coal-fired power plants.
Exactly. Nationwide, it's about 45% of our electricity comes from coal-fired plants, and that's more or less on par for us here in the Midwest. And, of course, that's rapidly decreasing. When I began to do my research 10 years ago for my book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, we were using a little over 50% of our electricity from coal. But that now has dipped down to 42 to 45%, depending on the quarters. And I think that's very notable, that just with a tiny bit of stimulus money now, for example, last year, our wind energy increased by 39% in the country, and that we're really starting to see a very positive shift to clean energy, things like solar, things like wind, things like geothermal, and also just a reduction in our consumption. I think we've realized that if we just had more efficient ways to have our buildings and to operate our electricity, we could save a lot of money as well.
Yeah, I think that's certainly an important point, and it's something I'm sure that people in various fields have been talking about for some time. That is, if we made our houses very energy efficient, and if you know, cost aside, if everybody went out and bought new furnaces and they bought new refrigerators and all of those things that we have that use power, and got ones that were the most efficient possible, that would make a huge difference in the amount of energy that we use. So there's a lot of energy to be saved if you did all those things that you could do.
Exactly. No, I think that's the way we're going. I think the truth is we're not going to replace coal tomorrow. And those of us who come from coal mining regions and coal mining families recognize that what we need is a just transition. That's how we term it, that we need to come up with a roadmap to have a coal-free future, because we really have to recognize the tremendous human and environmental and external cost of coal. And then if we have some sort of roadmap, let's say by 2020 or 2030 or even 2040, to get us off our addiction and dependence of coal to some sort of clean energy, then we can really begin to map it out and get there in a feasible way. Otherwise, I think what concerns a lot of us is we're just continuing this really devastating dependence on coal. And I think what a lot of the listeners don't know, and what I found in my 10 years of research, is that there's a staggering human and environmental cost to coal that we never really talk about.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Jeff Biggers. He is the author of the book Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, which looks at the history of coal production and what that's meant for the environment of Illinois and also the people who live in Illinois and down in the southern part of the state. That's published by Nation Books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I have a caller here, and there are a lot of things I'm sure we'll get into, but rather than make this person wait, we'll just bring him into the conversation. In Belgium, nearby, and this is line four. Hello.
Hello, and I would like to expound a little bit more on Vermilion County coal that your author just touched on. Now, I have to preface this by saying that all aspects of coal are dirty, and it's not my favorite form of energy, but to just go on the history of coal in Vermilion County, the Melvin family, who were the people who started digging coal out of the ground with the first strip mine, were located in what's now called Kickapoo State Park. And right associated with that was also a salt kettle that they, far previous to the coal mining, was also used to extract salt, just like you were talking about over on the Illinois River. Also, after World War II, in the 1950s, more coal was sent out of Vermilion County than any place else in the world. It went to Gary to build the steel that remade America. So coal has a very big, big prominence here in Vermilion County. And another thing I might mention, almost every bit of Illinois is got coal underneath of it, and several seams. Some of them are not at all viable because they're so thin and unuseful. Others are very thick and very, very valuable. And Vermilion County happens to be a portion of it. Because here in Vermilion County, especially right here in Danville, what happens is the coal seam comes almost up to the surface. It's what I call an anticline and a syncline. It's the way the coal is laid down and been folded. And our coal here, by chance, happened to be right on the surface in the Vermilion River, eroded down to it. So that's why they first started mining coal right here very close to us. And they also became a lot of what they call dog mines along the Vermilion River, where people just dug right straight into the side of the hill and provided heat and warmth for their families for years and years and years and years. Quite a history to coal over here. And thank you very much.
Okay. Well, you can amplify on that, or maybe also talk about your own experience in the southern part of Illinois.
Sure. I appreciate the caller giving us a history lesson there. I think that's very important. I think we need to make it very clear from the get-go is that, you know, my grandfather was a coal miner. My family's lived in Illinois for 200 years. I actually went to elementary school for a year, actually, in Danville. And I'll never forget going out to the Kickapoo State Park and seeing these lovely little lakes and recreational sites and realizing, God, these are old strip mines that have been reclaimed, supposedly reclaimed. And no one really talked about or discussed, like, well, what happened to the people who lived in the area? What happened to the native forestry? You know, how much diversity do we have in this park compared to what we used to have? And what really is the environmental and historical cost of this strip mining? I never thought about that until 1999 when I was working as a journalist in Mexico, deep down into the Sierra Madre. And I got a letter from my uncle who said, you know, what are you doing chronicling the cultures and the lives and the histories of other people when your own heritage was wiped out? And our family, we're from Saline County down by the Garden of the Gods, of course, which is a beautiful part of the Shawnee National Forest. And where we had lived for 200 years, the ninth generation of my family, essentially were forced out by the coal companies. Huge, massive explosions going into the valley. One by one, farmers having to leave to the point where my cousin had no choice. They destroyed his well. There was flywalk. There was an incredible amount of pollution. And it got to the point where he could no longer maintain his lifestyle in the backwoods there. This beautiful area. And when I finally arrived a year later, here was this huge, massive 250-foot hole. They completely strip-mined one of the most historic and first communities in Illinois, completely wiped it out, depopulated. Not only did they destroy some of the most diverse forests we have in the Midwest, a forest that rivals the Ozarks, but they completely had eliminated our heritage and our history. And it forced me to go back, just like I think we need to do with the Kickapoo State Park. And I realized there was this incredible history that we'd never known about, that, in fact, in my area of Eagle Creek, there had been
habitation by the Shawnee Indians. We had habitation of the indigenous people going back for thousands of years because of our incredible salt wells, that there had been legal black slavery first in the coal mines, that there had been an incredible union wars that, of course, my grandfather took part in. And then, of course, we had been fighting the coal companies for decades, if not over a century, for some sort of justice down here in this area. And I think that's the kind of history we need to reclaim when we go to a place like Kickapoo State Park, is not only we're trying to reclaim a few trees, but we're trying to reclaim the history and the heritage that was lost in the process.
Yeah. Just to go back and maybe amplify on some of those things, one thing that suddenly I'm sure might have got people's attention is this discussion about slavery. One of the things you write in the book is the fact that even though the state of Illinois was officially a free state, there was actually a loophole in the Constitution that allowed for slaves working in salt and coal mining.
Yeah, I think this is really one of the great secrets in Illinois history we prefer not to talk about. And I stumbled on it because one of the first cemeteries for black slaves was actually in Eagle Creek on our property that had been completely strip mined without a proper archaeological dig. What we found out is that going back to the very, very first coal mines in Illinois with the French brought in 500 African slaves via Haiti in the 1720s. Slavery then became a very common use in the coal mines throughout the country, of course, in Virginia and West Virginia and in Kentucky. But even in Illinois, in order to mine that coal, especially near the salt reserves, you needed a lot of labor, and they essentially had to bring in the black slave labor. When we had our Constitution in 18 finally ratified in Illinois, of course, we were great emancipationists, weren't we? Except there was one little loophole, that we could still have slavery where we got our number one tax revenues. And those came from the great salt wells down in Shawneetown, right outside Eagle Creek. In order to have that salt and those coal mines, we had to allow slavery, or our state founders allowed slavery. And that's something we've never really talked on, that slavery went on then for several more years in southern Illinois, and it was really folks like my backwoods people who had to fight it. They had to fight the 1824 convention to stop us from shifting to become a slave state, and they had to continually fight slavery for many, many years until the 1840s to finally get slavery out of the coal market. Mm.
Something else that I know that you're really concerned with and write about and want to talk about is that you're feeling that maybe there's no other place except maybe Appalachia where people are so maligned, so disrespected as southern Illinois, and that the picture has emerged. The picture we get is of a very backward people, and that somehow that negative picture of these people goes hand in hand with the exploitation of the resource.
Exactly. I think someone told me many years ago that's very true, is that the abuse of the land always goes hand in hand with abuse of the people. That as long as we can maintain a region where we treat people as if they're disposable, as if they're no count, as if those are just sort of stereotypical gun-toting white trash hillbillies down there in southern Illinois that don't truly matter to society, then we're allowed to remove them from their land. You know, strip mining takes place in 24 states, and of course, the poster child for the most horrific strip mining is in Appalachia, where we literally blow up entire mountains and push it into the valleys to go after the coal. And in the process, this strip mining has led to the largest forced removal of American citizens since the mid-19th century, since the removal of Native Americans, for example, with the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And this is, once again, one of the dark secrets about the coal mining industry we just don't talk about, you know, is that in order to get that coal through strip mining, ultimately you have a lot of farmers who are being pushed off their land. You had a lot of old pioneers pushed off their land. And basically nobody talked about it because there wasn't the level of advocacy that you would have in other places where we value people's culture. Mm-hmm. That it was very easy to discount southern Illinois, where I come from, because essentially we considered this area as a dark region of poverty and sort of a dark region of all sorts of machinations, of people who are disposable. And that kind of mentality continues to go on today. Let me give you an example that's happening just across your state in central Illinois, in Montgomery and Macoupin counties. There we have a new coal baron named Chris Klein who's coming into the region. And he's sinking these huge mines under the ground, not strip mines, but what we call longwall mining, where we don't actually have pillars that hold up the underground mines, but you remove those pillars through a special machine. When you remove those pillars, the land collapses. It literally, there's a subsidence of anywhere from 5 to 8 feet. And there's people who live above that land, of course. And there's beautiful farm fields. And those people are having to move off their farmland now. There's these historic farms and farmhouses that are having to be abandoned, literally because we're pushing through this type of very reckless coal policy. And this is the same thing that has been going on for 150 years in Illinois.
Yeah. We are getting close to our midpoint here, and I would just like to take the opportunity to, again, introduce the guest that you're listening to. We're talking with journalist Jeff Biggers. He is the author of the book Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. It's published by The Nation Books. He's also the author of The United States of Appalachia and In the Sierra Madre. He regularly blogs for The Huffington Post and for Grist. His stories have been heard on National Public Radio and Public Radio International and seen in many publications, among them Washington Post, The Nation, Atlantic Monthly, and Salon. And he will be here in Champaign-Urbana. He's coming to make a visit the beginning of next week. The folks at the Prairie Rivers Network is sponsoring a talk and a book signing, and he'll be talking about this very subject, the things that he writes about in his book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek, on Monday, October 25th, 6:30 in the evening. This will be in Gregory Hall on the campus in room 100. So anybody, I think, who is interested can stop by. And if you want to read the book, of course, you head out to the bookstore and look for it. And questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So would be a long-distance call. Use that number. And email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
In response to the maligning of longwall mining, I used to work on a longwall mine. I used to live in southern Illinois, grew up around coal mines, and I think it's better to longwall mine and have it fall in relatively quickly than to undermine it, leave pillars that are still going to fall in, only it may take 50 years, and have a next generation pay for it instead of the one that's getting the benefit of the coal. I think longwall mining's much better way to go.
I mean, I think it's fine as long as you're not living above the longwall mining.
They're getting paid.
A farmer like George Strunk down in Williamson County,
they're
for example. They're
buying their land. They're getting paid. I was down there. I worked around it. You know, I knew those farmers. The coal companies bought their land from them. They didn't steal it. You know.
Yeah, but you're not being forthcoming with the listeners here.
Be
quiet for a minute while I speak here. I've interviewed scores, if not hundreds, of farmers around the country. And these are people who've lived on their land like my family have for a century, if not two centuries. And then because, you know, someone in the family in the 1880s or 1890s sold the mineral rights, the coal company has the right to come. And you openly don't have a choice. Sure, the coal company offers you a certain amount of money for your land, but you have to take it or leave it because they are going to be doing longwall mining. There are many people who had to leave Williamson County, for example, who I interviewed who waited to the last second, who were heartbroken. These are people who've lived there for over a century who were forced off their land. So how dare you say that that's okay? You know, we can find our coal elsewhere. There is so much more coal around the country. We don't need to do it that way. That's very reckless.
I really want to we can't understand either of you if both of you are talking at the same time. I want to give, again, though, the caller a chance to
that was undermined. And one summer, both schools collapsed. The middle of town collapsed because of mine subsidence. But it was decades after the mines were closed, the mines were out of business, there was nobody to come back on. You know, we were left with a devastated town and nothing to do about it. You know, it's better to if you're going to get it, it's better to longwall it. That's my opinion. Thank you.
Okay. Well, again, I don't know, Jeff, I think you probably said what you think about it. I don't know if you want to add anything else to that.
Well, I mean, I think what's clear is, you know, here we are talking about a disastrous situation, and there's just no reason to continue with that sort of mining whatsoever. You know, the idea that either you destroy it now or you destroy it a little bit later is nonsensical. You know, you should just literally not be doing that kind of mining. You know, I think there are so many historic communities that have been disrupted, you know, and impoverished, too, because one thing your caller doesn't talk about is that mining is liquidation. It's not like we're harvesting the coal. It's not going to come back like the cornfields or the soybean fields. Once you take that mine out, once you destroy that community, that's it. You know, where I'm from in Saline County, we rank 98th out of 101 counties for the worst unemployment, the worst poverty, and the worst health care factors in the state. And yeah, we produce the most coal in the state. And coal has really left southern Illinois as this incredibly impoverished, really entrenched, impoverished area because the coal industry puts a stranglehold on any other kind of economic development. It puts a block on any kind of diversification of your economy. And the last thing anybody wants in any kind of part of the world is to have a single boom and bust economy. And that's what the coal industry does. It forces you to literally rely on that coal mine or nothing. And so your caller calls in, and he ultimately admits about the devastation from these mines. And he doesn't realize that he got a paycheck out of it, and he leaves the community, and he leaves it devastated, you know, with really an incredible legacy to live with. And I think that's part of the ruins that we have to have a reckoning with and really to move on to clean energy initiatives now.
Well, that does, though, I'm glad we got to this point because I'm sure that there are a lot of people who live in communities where there's mining who would say, you know, it's all well and good for somebody from outside the community to come in and tell us that this is bad, but they would support the mining and defend the industry because they would say, well, it provides jobs.
Yeah, and nobody would say that to you. You know, once again, I come from a coal mining family. I work in the coal field. And everybody knows that the coal industry employs less than 3,000 people in Illinois. The idea that the coal industry provides jobs is one of the greatest mythologies we had. We have lost more than 65 to 70% of our jobs nationwide in the last 25 years. And why is that? Because coal is heavily mechanized. You know, the longwall miner or the strip mining really requires very few miners now. And so coal is not one of these things that provides a tremendous amount of jobs. It has bled our jobs. We have seen it reduced and stripped our jobs down to nothing. In the meantime, coal has completely locked out any other kind of job-creating industries in the region because, once again, it's polluting. It's ruining the traffic. It's in an area that destroys the water resources and the air. Nobody else wants to open up a factory or do any other kind of clean industry if you have a coal mining. So we have to really get over this kind of mythology that coal provides jobs. The only people who defend the coal industry are on the bankroll, and those are increasingly a very, very, very few people, a handful of people. Once again, less than 3,000 people are employed in the coal industry in Illinois, and that's a fraction of the people who have lost their jobs, lost their communities, and are forced to live in very, very devastated communities.
Yeah. Let me ask you something else, because certainly another thing that has really hurt the coal industry is the fact that the coal that we have here in Illinois is very high in sulfur and creates serious emissions problems, and environmental legislation has made it impractical economically to mine this coal because nobody wants it. And so that gets us to the question, well, shouldn't it be possible to develop some kind of technology that we can burn the coal, get that energy, and yet deal with the emissions problems?
Yeah, but I guess the real answer to your question first would be why? I mean, just because we have 38 billion tons of coal beneath our feet in Illinois, if it's no longer practical to dig and burn, and if it's incredibly costly, then why aren't we putting those same subsidies, millions and millions and millions, if not billions of dollars of subsidies, of your taxpayer money to the coal industry, why don't we put that into clean energy? You know, we could train our coal miners, if we had a GI Bill for coal miners, to become electricians and plumbers and work in the construction industry and architects to make energy efficiency buildings, you know, to really create sustainable jobs, not jobs that only last for 10 or 14 or 15 years or however long that coal seam would last. We could do wind manufacturing and turbines. We don't have to put up windmills. We can build them. I mean, look at southern Ohio. It has so many factories now to build solar panels and to build wind turbines. You know, I think that's the whole point is we put millions and millions of dollars into subsidies to help the coal industry when, in fact, it helps our communities very little. And then secondly, you're not really recognizing the massive cost of the coal industry. Last year, over 13,000 people died from pollutants of coal fire plants in America. That's from the Clean Energy Task Force report that came out last week. 13,000 Americans. We spend an additional $100 billion on health care and external costs because of the coal industry that they're not picking up. Every day, three coal miners are still dying from black lung disease. Think about it. Hmm. In 2010, we diagnosed black lung disease, which is the inhalation of coal dust, in 1831. And still today, in 2010, three coal miners die daily. That's 1,000 coal miners every year from black lung disease. Have we seen, you know, coal mining is a very dangerous occupation as well. You know, and this is not to mention the issue of coal ash. You know, half the American populace lives within a half an hour to an hour drive of a toxic coal ash, which is seeping into our water resources. And then we have coal slurry, you know, which we're injecting into these old mines, which ultimately is getting into the aquifers of a lot of farmers in America and poisoning them. Every step of the way, from the mining to the transportation to the burning to the disposable to the ash, is deadly. The coal industry is deadly. And we haven't even begun to talk about the fact that 35% of our carbon emissions are coming from these coal plants and pushing us to the edge of even climate change. So there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to discuss how can we burn this coal cleanly. We can't. We can't burn coal cleanly. You know, Illinois has the worst mercury emissions in the country. But more importantly, we can't even mine coal cleanly. It's devastating either below ground or above ground.
We have some other callers here. Let's get back to the phones, starting in with somebody who is on a cell phone and line two. Hello.
Hello. This is pretty interesting. My daughter worked in the coal mines, and I don't think that there are too many people that think that coal mines are a really great idea, and I hope we get to the point where we can make energy in lots of better ways and put money behind that instead of behind the coal mines. But I think that in regard to your caller that you got in an argument with, there are three kinds of mining. There's not just strip mining and longwall. The other kind of mining is what was done for years and years and years in southern Illinois. And what they did was leave pillars in between the patches of coal. But the earlier caller was telling you, I think, was that that was a hidden sort of danger that people didn't realize for years and years. They were building their houses on top of land that was undermined. And you would get sinkholes and the house would fall in. And as awful as longwall mining is, and it is, at least people know it's going in and they know not to build a house on top of where the longwall mining. That's the distinction. Not that either of them is a wonderful way for people to make a living or to live atop of, but continuous miners or just guys with a pickaxe taking out coal from between pillars leaves a deadly, secret, silent killer that comes long years after it happens. And I'm pretty sure that that's what that earlier caller was alluding to, that that you're missing that particular kind of mining. And I'm sure you have studied that, but so far today on the radio, you've only talked about longwall and strip mining. I don't think anybody thinks that coal mining is just a wonderful way to go.
Well, again,
glad you're writing your book, though. Goodbye.
I appreciate the comment. I don't know, Jeff, you want to talk about that again?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a good point she's making. You know, the room and pillars is really how we've done it for over a century. It's really in the last 25 years that we shifted very much toward longwall mining. The disaster at the Upper Big Branch in West Virginia, which took the lives of, over 25 coal miners there, was a longwall mining. What we're finding is that longwall mining was invented as a way of just getting, you know, to more coal. You had an accountant who came in and said, oh, my God, there's coal on those pillars that you're leaving, and therefore we should find a way to take those out as well. And I think the issue is not after the longwall mining, it's during, that you have people who still live on top of these mines who are being basically forced to move off. And like I said, this is a huge issue for people around Hillsboro, for example. where you have these new massive mines coming in. Illinois, by the way, is really becoming ground zero for the coal industry, because I think a lot of people have realized in Appalachia, where they're doing so much of the mountaintop removal and the strip mining, that it's no longer going to be economically feasible. So they're switching back to the Illinois basin and, of course, the Wyoming basin, where we really get the lion's share of our coal. And I think in order to really maximize their profits, you have outfits like Klein Energy, which has really moved in big time into central Illinois, that's going to be doing largely longwall mining, because that's really where the money is, as opposed to the room and pillar.
And we've got some other callers here. Let me ask you here a couple of quick things that come in by email from somebody who's listening. Wants to know what your thought is on nuclear energy as a substitute for coal, and also your opinion about carbon sequestration. Again, this idea that you could burn the carbon, you could burn the coal, capture the carbon, and then store it so it doesn't get out into the atmosphere.
Right. You know, a couple of weeks ago, our tax dollars, $800 million of our tax dollars, were handed in an incredible check of welfare to Ameren, which is one of the giant utilities out of St. Louis. $800 million of our tax dollars were given to Ameren to come up with an idea to somehow burn the coal with oxygen that we could then try to capture these carbon emissions, compress them, and then pump them and pipe them across the state for 170 miles, and then try to sink them into the ground, and hopefully it'll work. You know, and Ameren and the rest of the country can tell you, we don't have a single scientist that can tell you that this can happen in a economically feasible way in the next 10 to 15 or even 20 years. We still don't have a clue about leaks or accidents. You know, and of course, we live between the New Madrid and the Wabash seismic zones in terms of sinking these carbon emissions. But even more importantly to me about the whole chimera of carbon capture and storage is, in order to capture these carbon emissions, compress them, pipe them, and pump them, you're going to need 20 to 30% more energy production because you're doing more things. And that means you're going to have to increase coal mining 20 to 30% more in order to go through the whole carbon capture and storage charade. And so to me, it's not only too late and too little in terms of dealing with our incredibly pollutant coal fire plants, but it really is one of the great scandals we've got going on right now, is that we as taxpayers are underwriting one of the great chimeras and boondoggles today. And I think that's really something we have to think about, is really, is it too late and is it too little? And ultimately, is it too expensive? And I think that sort of segues into nuclear power, is that nuclear power, for whatever discussion you want to have about potential accidents or how we dispose of the toxic waste, the real issue about nuclear power is financing, that they are just incredibly expensive now to build. It takes many years. It's not a transitional alternative. There's a huge water issue now with nuclear power plants. And then ultimately, it does come down to what the heck are we going to do with toxic waste? And I think that's one of these questions we still haven't been able to answer positively in the West.
Our guest this morning is journalist, author Jeff Biggers. His book is Reckoning at Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland. It takes a look at Illinois as a coal state and what that coal and the production of coal, the mining of coal, has meant for the environment, has meant for the people of the southern part of the state. The book is published by Nation Books, and we have, again, some other callers, so we'll try to get as many as we can. The next person up is Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm just interested in the ads coming up to this thing. You were talking about strip mining originating in Illinois. And I've always wondered how far back strip mining went along the Middle Fork and the Kickapoo area. I know as a child, my dad and I wandered through some of that area, and there were, you know, shallow strip mines in some places. South of 150, we ran into like air shafts where obviously there had been deep mining underneath the original surface mining. But I'm just curious as to how far back those old mine areas go. You know, I think when I was a boy, my dad ran a labor newspaper in Danville, and I'll bet you we had more than 3,000 miners in Vermilion County in the 1950s. And now he says that's how many we have in the whole state. Anyway, I'm curious about the information.
All right.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. We had so many coal miners when I lived in Danville in the late 60s, for example. And once again, because of mechanization, you really only have a handful now. Those coal mines go back to the 1850s. I think most people put the date at 1866 when commercial strip mining was born there in Vermilion County. But I think as early as the 1850s, you had, of course, horses and scrapers going after the outcroppings there.
And just maybe one other thing that we this may have come up, but I think that it's another real interesting point. You talk about how far back coal mining goes in the state of Illinois, and that it's one of the places where it's the place really where strip mining, intensive strip mining, started. Southern Illinois also was very important in the history of the labor movement in this country.
Right. Just a few days ago, of course, we celebrated, or at least I celebrated, Coal Miners' Day, which was always October 12th when I was a child, because that's, of course, down in the southwestern part of the state. We had a very important battle in Verdun. You had a company that from Chicago that wanted to break one of the strikes of the United Mine Workers. And, of course, the United Mine Workers really got their groove in Illinois. Not only did we produce John L. Lewis, but we produced some of the earliest and most militant United Mine Worker movements. And in 1898, the Chicago company wanted to break this strike that was going on, so they brought in black coal miners from Alabama and Tennessee, promising them that there was a lot of work and that all the miners had gone away to war. And, of course, it wasn't true. The miners had basically said that they were going to hold the coal company accountable, and they stopped the trains. There was a fight. There was an exchange. And at the end of the day, 12 people were killed, including 7 of the striking coal miners. This became known as the Verdun Massacre, and it galvanized the United Mine Worker movement across the country because they realized that miners were willing to stand up for their cause, that they had already won the right to an 8-hour workday as early as the 1890s, that they had worked for better workplace conditions because they had worked in abysmal conditions. And it was because of the United Mine Workers that you were really able to have some decency in the coal fields. And so October 12th, has always been called Coal Miner's Day. Of course, Mother Jones, the great miner's angel, is buried in Mount Olive, and I think that's one of the great landmarks we have in Illinois that people should really go, is to the only Union cemetery in the nation is in south central Illinois, in Mount Olive, Illinois, where Mother Jones is buried, in fact.
All right, back to Urbana for another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you'd comment on a prospective mining operation in southeast Champaign County. Apparently, it will be pillar and room and pillar type, although I think it's not definite. It won't be the long tunnel type. It sounds as though this is just, if it is room and pillar, just putting off the loss of farmland for 50, 60 years, and that in the end, a considerable amount of very fertile Illinois farmland will be lost.
You know, I can't address specific mine because I'm not really sure. You know, if you have a room and pillar, you're not going to have the subsidence immediately like you do with longwall mining, and therefore you don't lose the farmland or disrupt the farmland or the people who live above ground. So I can't really address the mine itself, but any kind of coal mine, of course, is going to have with it, for example, an incredible amount of traffic with coal trucks, an incredible amount of pollution, pollution both from coal dust and silica dust, an incredible amount of drain on your water resources. So no matter what kind of coal mine you're going to have, there's going to be a tremendous impact. And this is, once again, part of the cost that we don't talk about, that we as taxpayers have to pay for. In Kentucky, for example, they did a look at all the coal mines in the state and found out that, in fact, coal mines provide over $540 million of tax revenues. Okay? So we get a lot of tax revenues from the coal mine, $540 million. But conversely, the state of Kentucky was spending over $600 million on expenditures to maintain the roads, for health care, for abandoned mines, for environmental regulations, to basically clean up after the coal mines. And so, in fact, in the end, the state of Kentucky was losing $100 million a year because of the coal industry. And I think that's the same kind of analysis we have to make here in Vermilion County and everywhere else is, you know, sure, you're going to get a few dollars of tax revenues from the coal industry, but how much are you going to be paying as the taxpayer to pick up and clean up and to maintain a very egregious practice that we don't need any longer.
But eventually that room and pillar construction will still collapse, won't it?
Yeah, and that's the bottom line, too, is, and there'll even be more devastation further down the road for your children and your grandchildren.
Well, thank you. I don't think it's getting a whole lot of attention, and probably should.
It's a hard thing, and I really appreciate the interview today, and I think that's why I'm quite vociferous when people come on and try to justify what is really an egregious human rights issue and environmental issue for our generation. You know, once again, my granddaddy was a coal miner. I've grown up amongst coal mining people. I've worked in the coal industry now for many, many years. And to really chronicle the experience of people who have to live daily with this. And I think most Americans don't realize that we all live in the coal fields now because we all flick on that electricity and we all breathe the same air and we all are after the same water resources. And we're being really affected by an industry that should be part of our history books, an industry that should be part of our museums, not an industry that should be part of our future. You know, during this one-hour interview on the radio today, our nation burned 150,000 tons of coal, and over 250,000 tons of CO2 was released into air. Tens of thousands of tons of mercury went into the air and into, of course, the bodies of pregnant women and our children and into our water resources. That so much of the Great Lakes, for example, you can't even eat the fish anymore because of the high levels of mercury. That during this interview, this one-hour interview today, one coal miner has died from black lung disease. And three Americans are going to die today prematurely from heart and lung disease because of a coal fire plant. And that we're going to spend billions of dollars of our tax dollars today subsidizing an industry that's not picking up and paying its fair share for their damage. And so I think that's what we need to talk about with everybody is like, hey, where do you get your electricity from? There's no such thing as electricity fairy. And I think it's time that we all really examine the incredible cost that our electricity is beyond just our bill we pay monthly.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I find myself coming back, and a lot of people do, I'm sure, to the question of, well, okay, so how do we meet our energy demand? And in fact, I got a return email from the very first caller that we had, who obviously has a very strong disagreement with you and feels that he has some experience as a miner. Where he said he grew up in a coal town, worked in the mines for 10 years. He goes on to make the point, he says that as a country, we are going to use this resource. We just need to figure out how to use it safely and cleanly. And we do have a lot of coal. We do need the electricity. And as I think even you said, it's going to take time for green alternatives to develop. And even then, there are questions about just how much of the energy need they can provide. Is it completely unreasonable to say, you know, we do have a lot of coal. Why not try to figure out some way that we can use it and do that in a way that doesn't damage the environment, if that's possible?
Yeah, because it's not possible. You know, my coal miner friend who called, and in the end, we would probably enjoy sharing a beer with each other because I really come out as a defender of coal miners today. He knows that 10,000 coal miners have died this decade from black lung disease, and it's been totally needless that shouldn't have happened, and it shouldn't happen today, that coal miners deserve the same sort of respect because they built our nation through the Industrial Revolution. But I think he also would agree with me that coal mining communities deserve their fair share of the clean energy revolution that's happening in the rest of the country today. That billions of dollars now are going into communities to develop clean energy, and that coal miners should not only be subjected to coal mines, but the coal mining community should also have some of that investment fund. This is what's going to happen, is once again, we need a roadmap to get us off coal, and that roadmap is only going to happen if we actually invest in our communities and make the coal fields ground zero for the clean energy revolution. I believe, first and foremost, we need a GI Bill for coal miners that guarantees them a job if we take their job from the coal mines. I'm the first person who would defend any kind of coal miner's job. In fact, I have relatives who still work in the coal mines. And so I feel like that kind of just transition is only going to be possible, though, until we have something like a GI Bill for coal miners. We have a kind of training for transition programs for green jobs, like training electricians and plumbers and architects and construction workers for energy efficiency that can cut our consumption from 20 to 30%, that if we have clean energy manufacturing, that would be sustainable. Because once again, the coal is not forever. This idea that we live in the Saudi Arabia of coal, we have coal for the next 200, 300, 400 years, is completely illusory. The coal is there, but it's getting deeper and dirtier and harder to get to.
You know, even in Appalachia, every coal company will tell you we have less than 20 years left of accessible coal because it's just too dirty and deep to get at. And that's why they're doing mountaintop removal. And so we really have to consider this issue of peak coal, but more importantly, what kind of sustainable communities do we want to live in? Do we want our children to live in? And I think that is ultimately the most important question when we consider not only the devastating impact of burning coal to our skies and to our atmosphere, but also to our water and to our communities. And we really have to work to get off it. We have to think about how we can have a coal-free future. And that includes coal mining heritage as part of it, yeah. Part of this transition.
I'm going to try real quick to get in a caller here, Champaign County, line one. You'll have to be quick, but go ahead.
Okay, well, just I see it as a necessary transition. We can't get off it right away. And I'm really heartened by how adamant you are on this, and we do need to look past it. But this whole argument, just on the specific about longwall versus pillar, you know, there are structural engineers that can tell you what you have to do to replace that the support. It may not be absolutely 100%, but it would add to the cost of pulling out that coal. And I don't know if you've looked into this, but isn't it also the case that the aquifers are related to the coal seams, and that just willy-nilly knocking it out is actually going to change the water and the hydraulics of a region. So that's not something one can handle in a couple of minutes, so I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, Ian, maybe I can give you about a minute.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I think that's becoming a huge issue, is the aquifers and the whole irrigation. And I think that's what a lot of farmers are trying to educate people on in Montgomery and Macoupin County, is ultimately the devastation this will have on one of the most fertile farm areas in America. Mm. Is, you know, suddenly it's what's more important, to keep up the farm industry and the agriculture industry, or to go after coal when we actually don't need it. So I think it does raise many, many questions. I think really what I want your listeners to take away from this conversation is that Illinois really is becoming ground zero now for this debate over our future. And we have to realize what is really the true cost of coal mining. And it's not just the impact it has on coal miners and coal mining communities, but it's the impact it has on all of our lives. And I think what we really have to look at is seeing not only the environmental cost, but the health care cost, the external cost, and the cost it has ultimately on our future. And I think that's really the discussion we all have to have now, is it really worth it, and can't we shift to something else?
All right. Our guest, Jeff Biggers, his book is Reckoning at Eagle Creek, published by Nation Books, and he'll be talking on the U of I campus next Monday, the 25th, 6:30 in the evening, Gregory Hall, room 100. His visit here sponsored by the folks at the Prairie Rivers Network. And Jeff Biggers, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, how'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing, going into the paving business once again?
No, it's CarTalk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station, and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web.
To learn more, call 866-789-8627.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elman University in the historic Trivette Mansion across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
In the weather forecast, mostly sunny today and tomorrow with highs of 22, mostly clear tonight, the low around 10. For tomorrow night, partly cloudy, the low around 19, and partly sunny on Wednesday with the high around 32. There's a 30% chance of light rain and light freezing rain Wednesday night. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.